up today in the My Ag Life Daily News Report. We've been talking about the continuing water problems in California. Today, we hear from a water expert in Arizona and what she told a Senate subcommittee about water infrastructure. And we have today's news brief. I'm your host, Sabrina Halverson. We start today with a discussion about citrus with Tulare County Agriculture Commissioner Tom Tucker. And that is this week's My Ag Life in Citrus.
My Ag Life in Citrus is brought to you by Soil and Crop Incorporated, your number one resource for sustainable crop nutrition by putting nature to work for you.
I know that we are heading into bloom with citrus. Tell me how things are looking so far there in Tulare County.
They are looking good. We've had some pretty nice weather. And even though we've been in a bit of a drought for the last many years, we have had some recent rain and snow in the mountains. And that's always helpful to the trees because the rain in the area wets all of the roots and all of the ground around those trees. And so it helps get them a good head start towards moving into a bloom period. So we're looking good.
And from what I understand, citrus has more of a shallow root system than some other trees. So does it not require quite as much water to saturate through?
The majority of the roots are in the first, 12 to 18 inches. They will fan out, laterally around the tree, and which, as you mentioned, allows them to gather any water, whether it's irrigation water or rainwater, quite readily. Not that there aren't a few major roots that, go downward, but, for the most part, that's certainly true.
So how were things last year with the citrus crop?
Well, as always, there's a lot of citrus in this county and, of course, throughout the state, and it kind of depends. The crop itself was pretty good. I didn't see any real issues with that, but we did have some pricing issues, throughout part of the season. We made it through. I think everybody pretty well paid their bills, but, you always want to do a little bit more than that because you have a mortgage to pay as well. And so you always need to do better than just paying the bills. But nonetheless, we have some pretty good hopes for this season.
Yeah, and as we head into, more of the spring and get a little further into this season, I wanted to ask, how are things looking compared to last year so far?
So far, from what I've seen, they are looking good. We made it through the winter months without any freezes or damage from that fashion. We had a few isolated hailstorms, but they happened early enough. They don't appear as if they're going to be an issue for the fruit. So the fruit quality is coming off quite well. A lot of what we do here at the Ag Commissioner's office is to inspect the fruit at the pack line in the packing houses so that it can go export and meets all of the exporting countries' requirements. So our inspectors have been doing that right along and moving that fruit as quickly as we're able. The industry has hit a little bit of a hiccup or a bump with the problems at some of our docks with the shipping containers not being readily available and all that goes into that, but it's still moving though.
Is that something that we can go in further a little bit on this, the shipping and the docks? I know that it's been a problem for some commodities. Citrus is, more of a delicate commodity. You have to get them there at the right point before they are overripe or before they can't be sold. So are things going well in that front? Or are we still seeing a lot of delays?
Well, the last I heard, we were still seeing some delays, but I think there's been enough notation made about it and contacts with the higher up officials that they're trying to work through that system, as quickly as they can. You're right. Whether the products moving back overseas are not ag-related at all, perhaps, or non-perishable, you know, that's one thing. But citrus fruit, even though it will sit in a container for a while, it is perishable, and you don't want any kind of delay either at the dock or anyplace else for that matter. But I, from everything that I've seen, it's coming along, and I look for a pretty good season.
And of course, when we talk citrus, we, you know, the topic of the Asian citrus psyllid always seems to come up. So I know that just south of Tulare in Kern County, I believe that they have seen a little bit more, and all the way down south through into San Diego, I have talked with producers that are concerned with residential findings of ACP. How are things looking in Tulare County?
We're doing quite well here in Tulare County. We've only had one psyllid find as of this year, and that was at a packing facility. And the thought was that it probably was a hitchhiker, if you will, coming in on a load of fruit. And because the loads are all tarped, which is mandatory now, it didn't fly off along the way. When it got to the facility, you know, the fruit was brought straight in and dumped and washed and processed. And, you know, we have traps at those locations, and we were able to capture it. We put out a whole bunch of more traps in that same area, could not find any others. So we're looking good. We're going to stay vigilant. We're going to keep up on our tarping regulations. And we thank all of the haulers and the packing facilities, growers, you know, for understanding, because it costs them some money to purchase those tarps, to make sure they're on there correctly. But it's doing a lot. It's keeping that HLB from moving up this way, or at least wise moving any quicker than it needs to.
From the people that I have talked to in the citrus industry, they, you know, it, as you mentioned, it costs money to follow the regulations, and you have to put effort in. But I think people, especially in the industry, appreciate the effort that goes into it, because nobody wants that disease to spread through our citrus. We've seen what it can do in other areas. So has compliance been pretty good then?
It has. Early on, when all of this started some 3 years ago with the tarping regulations, you know, there was a lot of information put out, but with any kind of new regulations or program, you know, it takes a while to get everybody on board. And we worked with industry. You know, we didn't immediately go out, start issuing fines. It was all informational at that point. You know, hey, you're coming in with a tarp or without a tarp, and you need one, and here's the reasons why. Since then, there have been violations. On average, at least a while back, something like 25% of the loads, but it quickly became that they were not tarped at all, which is a big concern. It's that they weren't tarped properly. And that's a concern, because if you tarp 3/4 of the way down the sides, well, these little psyllids can make their way out of those bins really easily. They can drop to the bottom of the flatbed on the leaf trash and be swept away out to whatever neighboring citrus might be along the freeway. That's our biggest challenge, and we'll keep working on that one.
I was thinking of how involved the inspections must be. Just as you mentioned, they found one citrus, and we're talking about something the size of a pinhead, pretty much. They found one psyllid in a load. And so that must have been, the investigators must work very hard, because it has to be a very involved process, I would think, to find something that small in a big load of citrus. They put in a lot of effort.
They certainly do. A lot of it isn't so much looking for the psyllids in the loads, as it is making sure that the loads are coming in under a proper compliance agreement, the paperwork, so that we know that everybody in that pathway, the haulers, the growers, and the packing facility, all understand all the regulations. But we have, and to that effect, we have three inspectors working full-time during the season, working back and forth throughout the county, visiting all of our different facilities, making sure that those loads are coming in properly. Then on the other side, we have traps. We have these yellow sticky panel traps at packing facilities. We've got them in every citrus orchard throughout the county, and we're checking them regularly. And our inspectors are checking those. We're pulling them down, replacing them, and those are actually going to the CDFA laboratories for further inspection by somebody who has a either a microscope or larger lenses that they can look at these insects more closely.
And from that, can they determine if the insect is actually carrying what would cause the HLB disease?
Not generally. The problem with the sticky traps is as soon as that bug gets on there, he pretty well is dead, and they desiccate in a big hurry. And to pull them off of that sticky stuff and to try to test a dehydrated bug just doesn't really work. But, you know, most of the testing can be done either on the trees, obviously, but even though we're doing it here in Tulare County, it's just a outreaching, you know, scenario just to kind of track where HLB is at, and it's not here. But further to the south, Riverside, Ventura, and Southern, there are a lot of live populations. So when they find those live populations, they'll put them in a vial, they'll take them up to the lab, and then that's where they'll test for the HLB.
Okay. So what would you say, what do you think is the most important thing for the Tulare County citrus growers and citrus industry members to know right now?
Well, regarding ACP, I think they all know what they need to know. Just stay vigilant is the whole thing. You know, you don't get tired of tarping those loads. Don't try to sneak the last one of late in the day in. You know, it's not helping anybody. You know, just get it tarped, get it moved. Keep your equipment clean, especially if you work in another county. You certainly don't want to be moving the psyllids around that way. If we're expanding our conversation a little bit, you know, into citrus bloom, because that's coming up right away. We just heard in the news, and Citrus Mutual actually just forwarded their latest press release, and they've already declared in their south of 7th Standard Road as of March 29th. And that's pretty standard. You know, the three counties, Kern, Fresno, and Tulare, are all citrus bloom, have citrus bloom districts. And we all do the same thing. When 10% of the bloom is present on the trees, they are attractive to bees, and we don't want to hurt our pollinizers. So they will call bloom, and a lot of restrictions go in, most of them held in a California CCRs. So you can read up on there. You can call me or the local ag commissioner, and we'll help you understand all of that. But at that point, you know, you're restricted as to what sprays you can put on, when you can put them on, and when that requirement might lift, we call it petalfall.
And the citrus growers, and get all of that information on as well from your department, and like you said, from Citrus Mutual too. Is there anything else that you think we should be talking about today?
Well, that's the biggest action items that are happening right now. We're always staying vigilant on ACP. The citrus bloom is coming on, and that's going to be here for about a month. You know, for Tulare County growers, it's going to start in District 1, which is Highway 65 and to the east. That's always a little higher elevation. It's a little bit warmer, and of course, the trees will bloom just that much earlier. And that's why we have our two different districts. Then District 2 is everything to the west, which is a little bit further out into the valley. And so that'll go for another 3 to 4 weeks as well. So as we move through that time period, we keep all of our bees safe. We continue to do what we need to do. The growers have katydids to worry about this time of year. There are a few worms out there as well, but the katydid is a hard one to take care of. And unfortunately, right here as bloom is starting is the time to try to take care of it. So those that need to do it need to get on it quick, because the harsher pesticides that do a good job won't be able to be used during the bloom time. So these are a lot of things that the growers need to consider. The pest control advisors work with them on that. And of course, the ag commissioners and their staff, you know, we will help them to stay in line with all of the regulations and the laws that pertain. You know, we're all about trying to protect this industry, whether it be from the bees, the pests, or the movement of our crops. So, but beyond that, no, everything's looking pretty good. The weather's nice. If I continue on, I just encourage everybody to get a crop report if they would like to hear the latest values of the different crops and the work that they've all done. They can come to either here to my office, or they can go onto our website, and you can find it quite readily. There's actually an entire archive of years past, and it's quite interesting.
All right. It is. I actually, just before our interview, I was on your website looking through the crop reports to get my bearings again with how citrus was doing. So, and it is very interesting. I like comparing how it's changed from year to year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually have it open in front of me to the apiary products page, because we're talking about that. Mm-hmm. And looking at the totals for apiary products, which include honey, you know, orange and all the different other types, beeswax and the pollination services, we're talking about over $60 million in gross value in any given year. So, you know, it's good. Just like any industry, you know, there's a good, healthy apiary industry out there, and we want to keep that going as well.
Thank you again to Tulare County Agriculture Commissioner Tom Tucker. We're talking about citrus again today in segment 4. Stay tuned for that. But today's news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower, so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Here's your news brief for today. A Californian is named to a spot in the USDA. Oscar Gonzalez was appointed by President Biden to serve as Assistant Secretary for Administration at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He once served as the California State Executive Director for USDA's Farm Service Agency, where he oversaw FSA programs across the 58 counties in our nation's largest agricultural producing state. His government background includes working for California leaders, including Governor Gray Davis and others. Most recently, Gonzalez served as Vice President for Government Relations, Western States, for Goldman Sachs. Gonzalez served in the Obama administration in several senior positions with USDA, including as Deputy Assistant for Secretary of Administration, as well as Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations and Senior Advisor on Immigration Reform to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. How might various and, in most cases, non-lethal protection practices prevent predators from attacking livestock? That's the focus of ongoing USDA APHIS studies. Rod Bain reports.
Ever heard of integrated livestock protection? What is it?
An integrated system basically uses the best tools at the best time to use those tools.
Tools and strategies that in many cases can be non-lethal in their efforts to reduce or prevent depredation of livestock by wildlife. That according to Julie Young, a researcher with USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service Wildlife Services. Her colleague, Elizabeth Miller, says there is a mixture of non-lethal protection tools available to livestock producers.
Some of the tools that maybe are less traditionally employed would be things like range riding or flaggery or electrified fencing or permanent fencing. Those are some of the most popular.
APHIS's Wildlife Services last year implemented programs in 12 states that utilize several of these non-lethal tools and strategies, as well as educate producers on integrated livestock protection. Miller acknowledges that ILPs are not a one-size-fits-all approach.
If you consider all the different types of terrain, all the different types of predators, even size of allotments or accessibility of maybe summer grazing allotments, the list of variables goes on and on and on, and it really makes each individual depredation risk a unique situation, scenario to evaluate.
The pros and cons of integrated livestock protection tools in any one particular setting has been part of ongoing study. Julie Young says research on different components has taken place for years now, such as guard dogs, and the practice of a fence line with flags, perhaps even electricity, known as flaggery.
A few years ago, USDA did a study on livestock guard dogs and found them to be highly effective. But even though sometimes they can't solve every problem, we did a study a couple of years ago then on flaggery and found pretty good success on that, where people were setting up turbo flaggery and they weren't having depredation in the year that it was set up compared to the year before when they didn't have that.
And data is currently being analyzed on study of the practice of range riders. With eventually all this information gleaned on how not only various integrated livestock protection tools work together.
We have several sources of data that we'll be looking at, including man hours and cost. And we want to make sure that the amount of livestock saved, the amount of conflict reduced really matters and is worth the time and money spent on these tools.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service has entered into an interagency agreement with the Forest Service to add up to 600 of its dams to NRCS's nationwide DamWatch system. DamWatch is a web-based application developed to assist with monitoring and managing NRCS-assisted dams by providing real-time updates of rainfall, snowmelt, stream flow, and seismic events that could affect dam safety. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says Mexico's ban on imported genetically modified corn would apply to human food products, but not livestock feed. That understanding was revealed following his recent talks between Vilsack and his Mexican counterpart. Vilsack says limiting the ban is a relief for U.S. farmers and that it won't have a great as impact as it would if livestock feed was included at the same time as human food. Last year, Mexico published an executive order seeking to ban the use of GMO corn for human consumption, but did not define the products included in the ban. Mexico pledged to support imports of GMO corn with local production by 2024. Mexico imported around 16 million metric tons of mostly GMO corn in 2020. The Department of Agriculture Monday announced sanctions on five produce businesses, including one in California. The sanctions are in response to the businesses failing to meet obligations to the sellers of produce they purchased and failing to pay reparation awards issued under the Perishable Agricultural Commodities Act, or PACA. The sanctions include suspending the businesses' PACA licenses and barring the principal operators of the businesses from engaging in PACA-licensed business. The businesses are Urban Fresh Produce of California, Sunrise Produce of Maryland, PFI Express and Temple Turmeric of New York, and Eli Gonzalez Distributors of Texas. The act provides an administrative forum to handle disputes involving transactions, which may result in a reparation order that requires damages to be paid by those not meeting their contractual obligations in buying and selling fresh and frozen fruits and vegetables. That's your news brief for today. When we come back, we're talking about water. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Members of the U.S. Senate discussed water shortages last week. Four witnesses testified at the hearing. However, none were from California. Dr. Holly Richter, the Arizona Water Projects Director with the Nature Conservancy, spoke at length about water that affects California as well as Arizona. Here are her opening remarks.
Thank you for inviting me to testify today on incorporating natural infrastructure in Western water management. It's an appropriate topic during this week of World Water Day. I appreciate the committee's focus on solutions that support economic development, protect watershed health, and build more resilient communities. I'm Holly Richter, the Arizona Water Projects Director for the Nature Conservancy, and where I live and work, groundwater is the only source of water for people and nature. Fort Huachuca, the U.S. Army's premier intelligence and communications testing facility, depends on the same limited groundwater resources, as does the U.S. Bureau of Land Management's San Pedro Riparian National Conservation Area, located several miles away. The small towns and cities in the area do as well. When I first moved to Arizona, legal battles related to the limited groundwater supplies had started to emerge. And in response, the Nature Conservancy was a founding member of the collaborative group of 21 different stakeholders, the Upper San Pedro Partnership, to build consensus for hydrologic science that could help inform decision-making. Over the years, we worked with the U.S. Geological Survey to develop a predictive groundwater model to evaluate a wide range of alternatives. And what we learned together was that there were some significant ways to optimize groundwater for the various water needs of humans and nature. The partnership later joined forces with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation to conduct an appraisal-level study of water management alternatives that was completed in 2007. Today, we have much more clarity about the most effective options to replenish groundwater and to assure a vibrant economy, the operability of missions at Fort Huachuca, the health of the San Pedro River, and water security for local communities. The conversations over the years weren't always easy ones, but the co-development of the information to inform our decisions brought increased clarity and understanding. The vision for regional water management included replenishment of the groundwater aquifer at just the right places and amounts, using treated wastewater effluent and stormwater. We identified where too much stormwater was problematic, for example, where there was increased runoff from urbanized areas, and we flipped that problem into a water source asset. We looked at the demand side of the equation as well and retired high volume pumping and or precluded it in the future at the locations where our science told us it had the worst impacts to water supplies. The U.S. Army has been a critical partner for projects to support our regional water vision. The Army's Compatible Use Buffer Program, which is part of DOD's Readiness and Environmental Protection Integration Program, or REPI, has leveraged the efforts of this conservation partnership to address water security for all water users in the region. REPI funded us and allowed for the development of projects that could combat encroachment on military training, testing, and operations, and enhance military installation resilience, while also increasing water security for the entire region. And today, only three more recharge projects, totaling $21 million, now remain to be constructed by our consortium of project partners called the Cochise Conservation and Recharge Network. One of the remaining projects blends traditional and natural infrastructure approaches. Stormwater runoff from the largest urban area in the watershed will be diverted into a constructed basin to retain accelerated flood peaks in a way that slowly releases them back into the natural channel at a rate that will increase channel infiltration and groundwater recharge. The project will restore a more natural flood regime, it'll reduce sedimentation, increase water quality, and result in enhanced groundwater storage. I want to thank you for Congress's attention to water resources legislation. I hope that as Congress debates investments in infrastructure, that you will make Western water supply infrastructure a priority to increase water security in the West. We will need additional resources and funding for projects capable of leveraging natural systems as well as traditional infrastructure to convey and store water supplies. The example project I described today is illustrative of how traditional and natural infrastructure can be blended into one single project. But the inclusion of both types of projects within a given watershed can also leverage the benefits of one with another. As the primary federal water managers for the West, the Bureau of Reclamation should look at these types of innovation and solutions more often and implement them in collaboration with other agencies where appropriate, to build a resilient and multi-benefit Western water infrastructure for the future. I appreciate the committee's attention to Western water issues, and I thank you once again for the opportunity to testify today.
A specialist in the natural resources policy at the Congressional Research Service, Charles Stern, spoke on current research. Here's what he had to say.
Thank you, Chairman Wyden, Ranking Member Hyde-Smith, and members of the subcommittee. My name is Charles Stern. I am a specialist in natural resources policy at the Congressional Research Service, or CRS. Thank you for inviting CRS to testify. The committee has asked CRS to provide general context on natural infrastructure and how these concepts fit into the Bureau of Reclamation's authorities. In serving the U.S. Congress, CRS takes no position on the issues I will discuss today. Observers have used a variety of terms to describe both natural features and combinations of traditional hard or gray features with natural components that are used to restore or mimic natural processes. In this testimony, I will use the term natural infrastructure to collectively represent these features, but others may use different terms. Natural infrastructure can provide a range of beneficial functions. In the water availability context, natural infrastructure primarily addresses water supply rather than demand. Relevant efforts may include restoring forest, reconnecting rivers to floodplains, creating spaces for bioretention and infiltration, and combining one or more of these features with managed aquifer recharge. These projects may reduce flash flooding, increase stored groundwater, and improve late season flows, among other things. Some federal agencies have received explicit congressional guidance and definitions as to what constitutes natural infrastructure. For example, in 2016, Congress enacted definitions of natural feature and nature-based feature for the civil works authorities of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Congress also directed the Corps to consider these features in its project planning. Congress has also defined green infrastructure, a similar but not always synonymous term, for EPA authorities under the Clean Water Act. The differences in these definitions are delineated further in my written testimony. Other agencies conduct or support work on natural infrastructure under broad authorities. For example, NOAA has supported the use of natural infrastructure features to fulfill the agency's mandates, but Congress has not explicitly defined natural infrastructure in statute for NOAA activities. The Bureau of Reclamation has constructed more than 180 federally authorized water resource projects throughout the 17 Western Reclamation states. Over the last 50 years, Reclamation has constructed fewer new federal projects, but has expanded support for non-federally led projects, including those for water reuse and recycling, desalination, and water and energy efficiency modernization, among other things. The primary opportunities to incorporate natural infrastructure features into reclamation activities involve efforts to improve natural water storage. Most prominently, this might involve new managed aquifer recharge projects or additional efforts to restore riverine ecosystems, headwaters, and floodplains to a more natural state. In regard to groundwater recharge, generally reclamation does not manage significant aquifer recharge programs or facilities. However, the Bureau has experience with aquifer recharge activities in some locations, and Congress has authorized federal financial support for some geographically specific non-federal recharge projects. Additionally, several of Reclamation's programmatic authorities can be used to provide financial support for groundwater storage. These include grants through the Bureau's WaterSmart and Title 16 programs, as well as support for water storage projects under the 2016 Water Infrastructure Improvements for the Nation Act. Reclamation and water users have utilized some of these programmatic authorities for natural infrastructure more than others, and I outline the statistics of this usage in my written testimony. In regard to ecosystem restoration, Reclamation has typically aligned its ecosystem restoration activities with the authorized purposes of the Bureau's water resource projects, as well as with other relevant federal laws, such as the Endangered Species Act. Projects under these authorities may support river protection and enhancement, activities that in some cases may have the potential to improve water supply-related ecosystem services. The 116th Congress approved several changes related to natural infrastructure in the FY 2021 Appropriations Act. Congress added definitions for natural feature and nature-based feature for Reclamation's Water Smart Grants program. Notably, these were the first such statutory definitions for Reclamation. It also explicitly made these types of projects eligible for Water Smart Grant support. Congress also approved broad authority for Reclamation to assist non-federal entities with aquatic ecosystem restoration efforts in Reclamation states. Depending on funding and implementation decisions, some future non-federal projects under this authority could support natural infrastructure efforts. In discussing the future of natural infrastructure in Reclamation's activities, Congress may weigh the extent to which natural infrastructure might merit a set-aside or other consideration in Reclamation programs, including in WaterSmart or in proposed extensions of the WNAC Section 4007 storage authority. Congress could also consider enacting guidance directing how Reclamation should incorporate natural infrastructure in its activities, as it has done for the Corps. In doing so, how or if Congress defines natural infrastructure may be an important component in framing Reclamation's approach.
Dr. Bobby Cochran, partner of Community Resilience and Innovation at Willamette Partnership of Oregon, also testified.
And the partnership is based in Oregon, as you said, Senator, but we support communities all over the Western United States in finding solutions that improve the environment, improve health, and create a more inclusive economy. In particular, we implement solutions for natural infrastructure that save money and get better outcomes. So for us, natural infrastructure is an approach that uses any process of nature to provide a key service to community. So that could be filtering drinking water, reducing flood risk, increasing the ability to store snow and groundwater for later in the summer when we need it to grow food and drive industry. And right now, a lot of towns, especially our small and low-income places, are trying to find new ways to do more with less and provide the kinds of opportunities for their kids to thrive, take over the farm, get good jobs, and grow up to raise their families in town. And so we need infrastructure investments that do multiple things at once. And natural infrastructure is one of those key things in the toolbox, and I'll give a couple of examples. You know, first off, we can think of our forests as reservoirs. Oregon's seeing a lot less snowpack, which is our significant storage resource for a lot of the state, and that dynamic is true all over the West. Most of the water infrastructure, particularly the federal water infrastructure in Oregon, was built more than 50 years ago. So back when like Phil Knight was making shoes and a waffle iron, we can do better than that. And here's some examples of kind of where we're thinking of upgrades. So some research out of the North Platte River in Colorado is identifying opportunities for improved forest management that could actually increase water yields in the North Platte River by 55,000 acre feet a year. The cities of Denver and Santa Fe are already investing in forest restoration upstream of their reservoirs to prevent catastrophic fire that lets a huge dose of sediment fill up those reservoirs. And so there really is a role for Reclamation and partnering with upstream land managers to protect existing storage capacity and kind of lean into that opportunity for natural groundwater storage. There's also a really good upside for investment in natural infrastructure that every $1 million we invest in natural infrastructure, we see about 15 to 24 jobs created. And a lot of those jobs are local jobs. So basically every 90 cents of every dollar spent on natural infrastructure stays in the local community. And we found instances of natural infrastructure that actually created a restoration economy, that you had off-season forest workers and others being able to stay closer to home and closer to family. Restored streams are another really good example of natural infrastructure providing cool, clean, affordable water. One example to point to is in Southern Oregon for the cities of Medford and Ashland. They had a choice. We all take hot showers in the morning. That water coming out of the edge of the wastewater treatment plant was too warm for fish. We could have spent $16 million on a mechanical chiller, 100% sure to cool the water in terms of the end of the pipe, but did nothing relative to the broader habitat needs and broader community investments. So instead, Medford and Ashland invested in natural infrastructure, restoring streams in the Rogue River, and they did that at more than half the cost. So basically $6 to $8 million. And the upside of a lot of that stream restoration is when the Almeda fire ripped through this Labor Day, the restored stream actually acted as firebreak, preventing the fire from burning as intensely and burning as quickly, and prevented the loss of some key homes along the riparian corridor. So in general, we really need to think about how we can put natural infrastructure on an even playing field, and there's some things that Congress can help do to help establish that even playing field. One of the things is just make natural infrastructure eligible. The Water Resource Development Act of 2020 did that with a lot of the WRDA investments. FEMA has done that with a lot of its natural hazard mitigation approaches. So just making it eligible is simple. And then prioritizing infrastructure investments that create multiple benefits. So not only thinking about water storage, but thinking about benefits to habitat, affordability for ratepayers, particularly low-income ratepayers, and then also thinking about flood protection and fire protection as well. And then I think just thinking about bigger than shovel ready. So as Congress thinks about infrastructure investments or the role of the federal government, shovel ready doesn't invest in the types of broad solutions that we think are important. So thinking about coordinated permitting, monies to solve planning, money for technical assistance, particularly for rural communities, and making it sure that infrastructure needs to create resilient, inclusive economies, as well as the broader benefits.
No action was taken after last week's hearing. However, new water legislation has been introduced. Coming up next, a bonus interview on citrus. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
Welcome back. In case you missed it last week, I talked with Certified Crop Advisor with UltraGrow, Dustin Stewart, about the springtime needs for citrus. Here's a bonus run of that interview.
What I'm wanting to know is basically, what do citrus growers need to be thinking about right now?
Well, right now, everybody is going through getting out their first application, soil applications, typically a can 17 in the range of 10 to 15 gallons to the acre. You see guys putting out a couple of gallons of an NPK product, leaning more towards an orthophosphate, potassium hydroxide for the availability this time of year. And we are starting to look, or starting to see the feathering and early blooms emerging. So we're getting into that pre-bloom area right now as well.
What's the best way for growers to know exactly what they need?
The best way is to go out and pull a tissue sample that gives you a picture of what's going on right now in the field, in the tree, and you can make adjustments based on what those are.
As we're heading into spring, you know, we've had a drier year. Is that going to have an effect on what nutrients and what things they need to be adding?
It can. What you're going to be dealing with the drier winter is the accumulation of sodium in the soil profile. Because we rely on that a lot to push that sodium through the root zone to be able to leach it. So what you're probably going to be looking at is earlier applications of calcium, whether it be a calcium thiosulfate or gypsum, and then heavy irrigations on top of it to try to unlock that sodium and get it through the rhizosphere so we can have a clean root zone for all the other nutrients, specifically potassium, to be able to be taken up.
And have you been out talking with people, or are you hearing anything in particular that's going on this year?
Yes, been talking to a lot of growers, and as of right now, the market seems pretty good, but what I'm seeing is your general maturity navel picking has slowed down dramatically, and I see the packers or the house looking to pick the later varieties of navels. I think that's going to be a pretty big issue. I've heard talk of up to 60% of general maturity, your Washingtons or Atwoods, possibly not getting picked this year, or going to domestic markets. So the export isn't going to be there if if you haven't been picked, or it's going to possibly be mixed in with the late variety pool. So that's something that we are quite worried about. The Mandarin market seems pretty good right now. And all the other specialties, like we've had some trouble getting Caracaras and different varieties off in the past few years. Those have been going off very well this year. So it's kind of up in the air, but I definitely am concerned about the general maturity maple market right now.
What is it that I should be asking you, or what should we be talking about with citrus right now?
Well, right now, definitely we want to get ahead of the pre-bloom foliar application. So this is the time when, you know, we're getting ready to go into this bloom. So this is where we're going to be setting this year's crop. We want to make sure that our minor nutrients are in order. Specifically, top of the list is going to be zinc, manganese, boron. And then you're going to want to make sure that you have the phosphorus, potassium, nitrogen, everything in check. So a lot of times, it'd be just wise in general to go through with a pre-bloom foliar that consisted of some LB urea, good orthophosphate, a potassium hydroxide, possibly a potassium acetate, along with those three minor nutrients, the zinc, manganese, and boron. And you can also address any other, if you have any major deficiencies, that would be good to throw in the tank as well. This is going to greatly help you set a better crop for this season. And then as the weeks progress, once we get past this petal fall or this pre-bloom, we go through bloom and then get into petal fall. That's when we're going to be leaning really hard on your cell division. So that's going to last about 28 days after petal fall. And that's when we can influence how many cells are actually made for the orange that's being developed. And so we're going to see a lot of cytokinins or auxins, you know, some type of seaweed added in with maybe a calcium, potassium type spray, just looking at cell division, cell wall integrity. And then you have the rest of the season to fill those cells and make, you know, the biggest, you know, best size you can, best quality you can for your oranges. But everything, this is a very, very important time of year to make sure you get it right.
Okay, and that was something I actually was going to ask you, is how important is it to pay close attention at this point in the spring?
It's very important. You want to make sure that they don't, you need to make sure you're reducing as much of the stress that you can on it. So make sure they're irrigated properly. Make sure the sodium is addressed that could be present in the soil. Make sure that they have the nutrition that they're seeking. We're kind of trying to front load the trees right now, just to be able to set as much fruit as we can, you know, to have a better year ahead of us as far as yields are concerned. And then as the season progresses, we can work on sizing and other quality things. But yeah, very, very important.
So what is it that you would hope that all citrus growers would know right now?
That's a good question. Just make sure you've got, look at last year's nutrition, look at last year's soils and water, and take a good look at where you are. Think about where you want to be and what are we going to change to be able to achieve, you know, whether it be a bigger size, more yield, better color. And then what are we going to do different this year to be able to accomplish those goals, and work with your PCA, CCA to come up with a good plan and just stay on track.
That's our show for today. Don't forget, if you would like to nominate someone for the Farmer of the Week, you can do so on our website. Go to myaglife.com and click on Daily News. Then go to the top right-hand corner where it says Nominate a Farmer. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.